You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This is Gilbert Gottfried, Mrs. Gilbert Gottfried's amazing colossal podcast with my co-host Frank Santopadre, and we're once again recording at Nutmeg with our engineer Frank Verderosa. Our guest this week is a director, producer, and Emmy-winning and Tony-nominated performer, and one of the busiest and most recognized television and film actors of the last 50 years. You've seen him in TV shows like Police Story, The Streets of San Francisco, The Paper Chase, Law and Order, and Homicide, and features like The 7-Ups, Fist, God Told Me To, Blood Brothers, City Heat, and The Jura, as well as the film classics The Honeymoon Killers and a movie we've discussed quite a bit on this podcast, The French Connection. He's also been praised for his stage work, including his Obie-winning role in the play Yanks 3, Detroit Zero, as well as his Tony-nominated role as Eddie Carbone in Arthur Miller's A View from the Bridge. For the past 30-plus years, he's toured the globe in a series of one-man shows based on the life of his childhood hero, Fiorello LaGuardia, whom, I'd like to add, was one-quarter Jewish. He's also an acting teacher and a member of the world-famous Actor Studio, and he continues to tour the country with an inspirational lecture called From Brooklyn to Broadway and Beyond. In a long and successful career, he shared the stage and screen with Clint Eastwood, Gene Hackman, James Mason, Laurence Olivier, Hal Holbrook, George C. Scott, Anthony Hopkins, Christopher Walken, and one of our favorite actors here, Rod Steiger. Please welcome an artist of many talents and a man who once came to bat against the legendary Sandy Koufax, the pride of Bensonhurst, Tony LoBianco.
Well, hello, hello. Well, thank you for that introduction. Fantastic.
Hi, Tony. He almost called you the bride of
Bensonhurst. The bride, yes.
That's the Lanchester.
And to all the people out there, if you don't know the name Tony LoBianco,
shame on you.
Yeah. First of all, shame on you. But type that name into your computer or iPhone, and I guarantee when you see the picture, you're going to go, oh, that guy.
That's him.
Yeah.
Tony, thanks for coming.
A pleasure, Frank. Pleasure to be here.
As I was saying off mic, it's nice to have one of my people. It's been so long.
I prefer when it's Jews here. But
you're outnumbered tonight with Verderosa, LoBianco, and Santopadre.
But he did prove his Italian roots when I was saying that my wife was nagging me that I should run next door and get something to eat.
Exactly.
And then I said, well, you're here. I don't want to interrupt. And you, in an old world guinea way, said, no, get something to eat.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Totally Italian. And I cook too, as does my wife Elise, very well.
Now another thing, I was born and raised in Brooklyn.
Wow, that's a whole
all
bunch
three
of
us.
All three of us in Brooklyn. Wow,
and so
He's
many
Coney Island boy.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, Coney Island, then Crown Heights, and then Borough Park.
Yeah, I was Bensonhurst, Bay Ridge, Bensonhurst. And moved around a bit. We had I moved to. Three times before I was 10 years old, ending up on 18th Avenue, 49th Street. It was quite an experience being born in Brooklyn. There's so many people in our business who have been born
really
in Brooklyn.
Are.
It's amazing.
So many on our podcast.
I was telling Tony, we got about 40 or 50 people from Brooklyn on this show.
Yeah, that must be something in the water. But I think growing up in Brooklyn gives you a real perspective on life. Because I'm sure either of us have had a silver spoon in our mouth when we were born. My father was a cab driver, mother, a housewife, and so on. And being poor, what would be considered poor, you don't know any better.
No.
And as my brother recalls, toys. I think we had one toy each, and. We didn't know the difference. It didn't matter. I always believe that struggling gives you an education, and the harder you have it, the more you know. The more difficult life is.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
Well, your dad owned a hardware store. I mean, you guys weren't flush, and my dad was a struggling commercial artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When we lived in an apartment in Coney Island above his hardware store.
Oh, that was wonderful. Coney Island. I remember my trips there as a kid and as a teenager. Wow, it was a whole other life,
Different universe. Going
to... And it's so funny because me and my wife have said this to our kids a few times, and to hear you say it, that also growing up you had like one or two toys. That was it.
Sure.
Now it's like they want every single toy.
They don't even open them all when they get them for the holidays.
Oh,
they stack them over the race.
As their favorite toy is generally the box.
The box.
The box and all the toys are on the side.
Tell us about your family, too, since we're talking about it. It was a big dramatic family, as you describe it.
Always dramatic. The idea of I was fortunate enough. My mother had seven brothers. And so I had uncles, and the idea to have someone to look up to was tremendously important. And we had stories, and the stories that our parents told us, because they had hardship. My mother was from the Lower East Side, my father was from Brooklyn, and they all had sixth grade educations, because they had to get out and work and support the family and so on. And my mother was one that took care of everybody, our brothers and so on. And that kind of the stories that you hear back then of struggle. I mean, when she first was a kid, they took her out of school so she can go sew coats at Howard Clothing. You remember the Howard Clothing way back then? And then when the inspectors would come around because of child labor laws, they'd hide her in the bathroom.
Unbelievable.
So, I mean, that's the way they grew up and the struggling, all that struggling. And the stories from my uncles, and oddly enough, with our brothers, somehow, some way, especially back then, one of them only smoked, and one of them only drank, which is very odd, when you think of that, and the idea of achieving things with struggling always is very important to me. I'm still doing it. Listen, tomorrow. I'm pitching a softball game.
I love that.
You know what I mean? Struggling is what I do because good is nothing. Excellent. And doing what you can't, I think you can accomplish. And it's the same thing I try to do with my acting as well. Playing Fiorello LaGuardia is not quite the way I look or the way I behave. And his whole manner is a whole different human being.
Mm-hmm.
He had a different kind of a voice than I had, and certainly he was rotund and overweight, and his manner was much more so on. But creating characters is what it's all about, as far as I'm concerned. When they talked about being a character actor, to me, as far as I'm concerned, every part I played is a character. I don't know any script that's ever been written that said Tony LoBianco.
I don't know that part.
Right, of course.
Never played that part. So it's fascinating, you know, of course, being Italian and being pretty good at playing the gangster stuff and looking Italian, you get cast that way. And those are great roles. They're very rich roles as an actor to play. But the whole idea to me of acting has, quote, nothing to do with me.
Well, you've also been in biblical epics. I mean, a lot of range.
We did Jesus of Nazareth.
Yeah.
With Laurence Olivier Zeffirelli, the great director.
You've played every kind of part.
Zeffirelli. And also I did Jacob and Joseph.
Right.
And that was a fascinating situation because when I left to go to Israel to shoot it, playing Joseph, I played Joseph, and Keith Michelle played the Jacob. Colleen Dewhurst was in it, mm-hmm. my mother, Jacob's mother. Anyway, when I went there, Israel had just shot down 6 Syrian planes. Syrian, huh? Familiar. And I said to my then wife, I said, well, war is going to break out. When I arrived, the day I arrived, war broke out, the 6-day Yom Kippur War.
Mm-hmm.
And I somehow convinced my producer and director, Michael Kakianis, who directed Zorba the Greek, to stay while everybody was ordered to leave Israel. And I somehow sat down and we talked about it. I said, stay. Israel's never going to lose a war. And so, Moshe Dayan and we're all rushing. We were at the hotel in Tel Aviv that was headquarters. And so they'd be rushing in and out and holding news conferences there. And, of course, the war was getting worse as it was going on. And I was going around doing interviews, saying to the Israelis, don't worry about a thing. America's on its way. America wasn't on its way.
Wow.
And you know what I mean? So I was doing a lot of PR. And what happened was I finally convinced them. I said, you know what would be a good idea? Just for morale, because most of my brothers, the 11 brothers, were all Habima actors and also in the military. I said, it'd be a very good inspirational thing if we started filming. They said, filming? There's a war going on. And we're filming on the desert. I said, it could be good. So I convinced them to film. And it was so wonderful because the brothers were in their robes and were doing a scene. And we had the script girl listening to the radio for their number to be called to go to the front line. And when the soldier who was my brother would stop, take off his robe, his uniform was underneath his robe, pick up his Uzi, jump into some kind of a truck, and go to the front line and do his 8 hours. Well, that's the way we shot the film.
Wild.
Isn't that something?
That is nutty.
Wow. Yeah, that's a great story. That's a great thing. You know, it was, and we kept shooting and filming, and I hate to use the word shooting under those circumstances.
Yes, of course.
it was quite something, yeah.
Now, I heard somewhere, too, that you, when you're in a production, a play or movie, you're not one of those actors who's just concerned with your part and your lines, but you want to know every single thing, every job that's being done.
Yes, I do indeed. As a matter of fact, even that when I first went to acting school at the dramatic workshop that used to be on 50th Street in the Capitol
Theater.
Yeah,
it's gone now.
Yeah, gone across from the Winter Garden.
Mm-hmm.
When I first went in there as a kid, 17 years old, to be an actor, which I knew nothing much about, except I had entered a contest in high school and did very well. I was representing Brooklyn.
That's right.
The 5 boroughs.
That's right.
You, to jump in with something, were also named King of Brooklyn?
Yes.
that came later.
That's later. As a fact, it's on that pathway in the park. It's on the ground.
I'm sorry we didn't put that in your intro. And the King of Brooklyn.
King of Brooklyn. And Lainey Kazan, my good friend, was the queen.
Oh, I love
of
that.
Brooklyn. Yeah. So when I went to acting school, the first thing I did was I said, you have a stage here. Let's put plays on. And I said, I want to learn about lighting. I want to learn about mopping the stage. I want to learn about putting the sets up. I want to learn everything like that. So as a result of that, you know, when I'm in years gone by, when I'm acting, I always hang around the camera. And I always watch to see how the director is communicating, not only with the actors, because most of them don't communicate that much with the actors, but being an actor, I know how to communicate, you know, working with actors, and see how much time they waste. It's a big deal, you know, how much time they waste on a set, you know. And so when it came time for them wanting me to do more police stories, I said, okay, I'll do more police stories, but let me direct one. So that's how I got into directing. I had not directed except for the stage.
Right.
Because I started a theater at the Triangle Theater here in New York in the 60s. Because I always believe that you can't wait. In this business, you know, you spend most of your time waiting, obviously, and that's what you get paid for, waiting, not doing your job. But you got to create. You have got to be the guy who is a leader. And thank God, somewhere along the line, I've always been.
You're a self-starter.
Yeah.
Well, tell Gilbert you the how dating a Jewish girl kind of led to an acting career. You were going
to
go there?
I was just going to go there because, you know, I have to lead it to
Judaism. I'm feeding you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I'm giving you what you want.
Tell us this.
Well, you know, I was dating a gal named Faye Newman. And yes, she was Jewish. And I was sort of 16, I think. And the teacher in school, Miss Jacobson, my mentor, I went to a vocational high school, William E. Grady Vocational High School. Had no guidance, had no, you know, telling, well, what kind of school do you want to go? I had none of that.
And there was no showbiz in the family, by the way.
No,
either.
It was the school I went to. It was the closest school to my house.
Okay.
You know, so it had to be a vocational high school. And I had no interest in sheet metal working or mechanics or whatever, woodworking or what have you. Fortunately, my brother was a commercial artist like your dad.
Oh, interesting.
And he had a commercial art school there, class. So he took it, and I know any better, so I took it too. He had talent. I did not. And I was fortunate enough to have this teacher, Patricia Jacobson, who, another Jewish lady, and she... there was a speech and drama class in this vocational high school, which is shocking to me. But she liked me, and I think because she was friends of the mother of the girl I was dating, who was not too thrilled with her daughter with a shiksa, you know what I mean? And so somehow she cut me out of class to be in her class, and we'd talk. Talk about life, talk about this, that, and the other thing. And it sort of came around, let me know that she was a friend of, you know, and friend of the mother. It was very subtle and very good. But thank God I was perceptive enough to understand, because as we say, the streets, I'm life taught, you know, street taught. And I can pick up on people's vibes of what they're really getting at and their behavior and their body language and all that jazz. And so I understood that. But in the meantime, she had engaged me. A contest had come around, and she somehow, some way, talked me into doing this speech. And it was, you know, it's so, as the circle goes, I went home and my aunt lived underneath us in Brooklyn, and it just so happened, I said, she wants me to do some kind of a speech. And it just so happened that her sister was there, a younger sister, and she said, well, what about this poem? And it was a poem about a soldier dying in a foxhole and discovering God for the first time and having a conversation with God. And so it touched me again. And I say that because of the circle of the video I did. We'll talk about later.
Yeah, we'll get to it.
So I did this speech, and I won. I won in my class, and then I won in my building, and I won. We had three buildings, and I won for the whole building. Here I was now in this contest, and then she changed it to I Have a Rendezvous with Death, and she changed it again to Cyrano de Bergerac. Where you do that whole speech about the nose and so on and so forth. And here I am, I won for my district. And now I won for my borough. I won for Brooklyn.
It's a lot of pressure.
I mean, it's astounding. It's astounding. And there I was representing Brooklyn in the city finals of the five boroughs. And I didn't win, but because that was the time, I didn't win because it was some young guy did a speech about communism, and it was a wonderful time to do that speech. You know, it was the 50s, 53 or 4. And so in a very patriotic speech, and he won.
But you had the bug at this
that
point?
That gave me, before I knew I was graduating, mm-hmm. and I was always athletic, so I played baseball, and I was also a Brooklyn Dodger rookie tryout we had at Ebbets Field.
That's cool.
Of all that, amazing, and that's a whole story in itself.
Well, though, with Al Campanis and all that.
Oh
stuff.
Yeah, you
that's
know
a,
that. You
yeah,
know,
it's yeah, interesting yeah. stuff. I know who he was too. I'm a baseball guy.
Yeah.
But tell us briefly, since you mentioned it, tell us about coming up to bat against Koufax.
Well,
Jewish, Gilbert.
Oh. Yes, a Jewish and Koufax, and the greatest pitcher.
Maybe the greatest pitcher that ever lived.
Yeah, fantastic. I used to watch him, on television when he'd throw a strike and he was unhappy. Because it was not the strike he wanted to throw.
Imagine.
Just on the edge. And that's also a great teacher as far as I'm concerned, because that teaches me a great deal. I always want to get it right because, acting is the only place where you get to do life over.
That's interesting.
Wow.
See? The only place you get to do life over. Cut. Let's do it again. Let's fix it. I come back next night on a play. I'm always fixing. It didn't go perfect. And, we'll never get it perfect, So, but that's it. That's what you do. That's what you're supposed to do. Keep working and making sure you're doing it. So I'm a stickler for that. So when he throws a strike and it's not exactly where he wants it, that's my man, you see. But anyway, I was off probably doing work on this speech.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the all-star first baseman,
right?
Would you believe? And only because I was I had a Pete Rose mind set.
You threw yourself into it.
Oh man, yeah. I tell you, it didn't matter what the score was. But anyway, I came back to this game, and I said, "What's going on?" He said, "Guy's throwing a no-hitter against us." I said, "Put me in." So I got in, and I was the last batter to face Sandy Koufax.
Oh wow!
And he throws this pitch, and I got to hit the ball. Out for an out, a fly ball to right field, but I got to hit the ball.
You were the 27th out?
Yeah, I was the last out.
Nice. There's some honor in that.
What a great.
That's a great story.
Yeah. But that other story, about the trial with the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Tell us,
because
it's fun.
When we get to, having a tryout, we're all warming up, and we come out in the dugout. And Al Campanis, who was then a scout,
right? He later would become the GM of the Dodgers.
Right. He says to us, "Now listen, nobody walks on this field. When your foot touches Dodger dirt, you run." So I was so excited to be there. When my foot touched Dodger dirt, I got a nosebleed. And I'm trying to get my nose to stop bleeding, and I'm on the field, and I'm running to the outfield, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, and I'm seeing all the signs and all the billboards.
Right.
Oh my God.
Hit this sign. What was it? And win a suit?
Yeah, whatever.
All
kinds of things. So I'm bleeding over there, my uniform and the glove. By the time I got back to someone, everybody was assigned to this, that, and that was a disaster. But years later, I become very good friends with Tommy Lasorda. The manager
sure.
of the L.A. Dodgers, and Campanis is now, as you said, the general manager. And I'm sitting in the booth with him, watching Doc Gooden pitch against Sid Fernandez.
Uh-huh.
And I'm watching it, and I see Doc Gooden go into his wind-up, and the Dodgers get a runner on first base. And I said to him, "You can steal on this guy easy." He goes to his wind-up up here.
Uh-huh.
So he calls to Tommy, says, "You could steal this guy." Goes on, boom, guy steals the base.
So you're scouting for the Dodgers at this point.
But it's amazing. You're a ball fan and you understand, you watch these guys play sometimes and you say, they don't know.
I'm picturing Doc Gooden's windup now, and yes, it was very deliberate.
Well, yeah, now he comes set, does a slide step,
Right.
But,
and
I
you're
mean,
still playing ball. Now.
I play. I got to pitch tomorrow.
That's fantastic.
I'm pitching again. I won 8 championships in the softball league. And I was born show leagues over here. And I'm the only player that won MVP 3 years.
Broadway show league?
Broadway show league. 3 years in a row. And the fourth year, The commissioner wouldn't give me the award. He said, yeah, I can't give you a four. He said, it was my best year because I pitched a no-hitter. And he said, I can't give you a four. He said, you should have four, but I can't give it to you. But that was
Did it break your heart when the Dodgers when they left?
Yeah, but actually, you know, I was a crazy guy because even though I was born in Brooklyn, I was a New York Giants fan.
Wow.
Willie Mays.
That's sacrilege.
I know, that's sacrilege. My brothers were Yankee fans, too, so it's wild.
Now, did you do some prize fighting, too?
I did.
You sure did.
I did. I did club fighting, and then I went into the Golden Gloves, the famous Golden Gloves. And that was quite something. And even my first fight, as a matter of fact, as a result of my life, I've written the movie, and it's called Pistol Pockets. And I don't know if guys remember. I'm a little older than you guys, and maybe a lot older. But there's a period of dress code called Pistol Pockets, and it was peg pants, saddle stitched down the side, and flaps on your back that were in your back pockets that were shaped in a pistol, a piece of cloth. And the movie is about my life growing up with the teacher and with it only stays right at 18 years old. But it also includes boxing and it's a good, real wonderful come of age, and Warner Brothers are looking at it as we
speak.
Very
cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And how were you if you had to rate yourself as a fighter?
I was a good street fighter. You know, I used to fight all the time in the street. But in the ring, I only had about four or five fights. And when I lost one, that was the end.
That was it.
I said, I'd lost again.
You weren't going to be Rocky Marciano.
Yeah, exactly.
Undefeated.
Yeah, right. So this hurts.
You know, I was watching Marciano, too. I was watching the movie
you did some great research.
Well, I dig in. And I was watching the boxing scenes, and I'm thinking, this guy knows how to throw a punch. Well, clearly, because in some movies you watch boxing scenes, and they look rather silly.
Well, you know, as it was the case, and I did Yanks 3, Detroit Nothing, Top of the 7, playing a baseball player, mm-hmm. pitching on stage. Hal Prince hired me to do it. He was the original director. And he got let go, but I shouldn't say he got let go. They had a difference of opinions, and I think he might have quit. But what happened was, when I got on stage, I started pitching, and he said, what are you doing? I said, what do you mean? He said, you're pitching with your left hand. I said, yeah, I'm left-handed. He said, well, that's no good, because you got your back to the audience. I said, okay, I'll go to the other side, pitch from there. He said, that's no good either. He said, because that's a weaker side of the stage. I said, okay, I'll pitch right-handed. So I can throw right-handed and left-handed, you see. So I pitched the whole game as a Yankee ball player, Yankee professional pitcher, as right-handed with the wrong hand, right? And Steve Garvey, Steve
sure.
from the L.A. Dodgers, he came, he never believed, he said, I never seen an actor portray a baseball player as authentic as you had. And I said, I'm doing it with the wrong hand.
Wow.
He almost fainted. That's fun. But again, playing the heavyweight champ of the world, the only undefeated heavyweight champ of the world, Rocky Marciano, was right-handed. So I had to fight right-handed. Because when I boxed in the gloves, and so I boxed left-handed. No. I do that. You know, I can...
When you prepare for a part, I heard you decide if the character is right-handed or left-handed.
And I'll tell you a great story about that. Why? Because I see, as I said to you before, you know, I watch behavior.
But why do you do that? Why do you make that choice?
Because I can see, you talk about Rod Steiger, okay? He's so left-handed, it's disturbing.
not sure what that means, but I love it.
Well, if you ever watch him and perform, it's a caricature. I mean, I'm sure all his characters that he plays are not left-handed. You understand? So, you know, so I play some true life characters too. And so let him know if they're right-handed, left-handed. So it saved my life. I was in Genoa, and I had chosen this character to be right-handed. He's a detective from New York, And I chose him to be right-handed. And so the director, I'm running down the street in Genoa, and the director says to me, "I want you to shoot at the fleeing bus." Maud Adams was on the bus running.
Maud Adams.
Yeah. Yeah. So I said, "I'm a New York cop." I said, "I can't. What am I going to shoot at a bus?" He said, "Shoot." So he said, "Oh, I'll blow a tire out." He's so baloney. So he just went. So I'm thinking, "Oh my God, what am I going to do? All right, I'll make this director happy. I'm going to argue with him." So there I go. I'm running down the street, and I'm going to shoot the thing. And all of a sudden, a real police car comes by here with guns out the door on me, seeing me with a gun running down the street.
Wow.
And I see it. I go, "Whoa." I turn my hand back. They cut in front of me. They jump out of the car, and everybody's screaming, "It's a movie. It's a movie. It's a movie." So now everybody's pale and exhausted, excluding the cops. And the conversation in the car is, "Shoot him, kill him, kill him, kill him." And somebody say, no, don't fire, don't kill him until he fires the gun. So if I follow the director and I shoot the gun, I'm a dead man. If I'm left-handed, I run down the street this way, I don't see them. I run this way, and then when I do see them, I go like this. And they blow me away. My hand goes right in front of the cop's car, and they shoot me. But right-handed, I just lay back.
You lucked out.
So it saved my life.
Wow.
You know, making those choices about being left-handed or right-handed as my characters. Yeah.
How bizarre.
It's bizarre. Yeah.
And since you mentioned him, because we've mentioned him a lot on this show.
We talk a lot about Rod Steiger on the show. Gilbert loves the pawnbroker.
Oh, yeah.
I used to play poker with him.
Yeah.
Jerry Vale and so on.
What was Rod Steiger like to work with?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story. When we were working on Jesus of Nazareth together, we also did Fist.
Yeah, Fist for Norman Jewison, yeah.
So he came and he said, "Tony, I'd like to, work out because we'll do some rehearsal because, I want to get away from the Steiger. So we do this scene, and I'm, as far as Steiger is concerned, I'm an audience. We have a scene together, but because every to finish, he says, "How was it? Was there anything? Any good?" I said, "Yeah, it was good, Rod. Let's do it again, though. Let's do it again." Now I become his director. He thinks I'm an audience, but now I'm, "Yeah, it was pretty good." So now we do the scene again. "Was it anything? Was it anything?" He kept saying, yeah, Rod's fine. Well, the funniest part about his entrance in that movie on a horse, when he came in and we had a big crowd, Zeffirelli and, of course, and all the people above here and so on and so forth. And he comes in. He does his scene. He exhausted. He comes in, gets off his horse. When the scene is over, he looks. Applause. And Zeffirelli going, applause.
Fantastic.
Applause.
Was he a character? You spent time with him socially, too? You played cards with him?
Sure. We played at Norby Walters.
Norby Walters card game.
Yeah, on Wednesdays. And
somebody else, one of the other guests we had on the show played in that game.
Sure.
I'm trying to remember who
just
it was.
Just fun. It's just, hardly any little.
He was one of those actors that when he got into character, that was it. You couldn't call him by his own name anymore.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
I don't know about that. It was funny. He's a wonderful guy and a friend.
Don't go away. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Gilbert and Frank. They're the ones that you can thank.
And now back to the show.
What was the first big turning point role? Was it because you'd acted before? You'd acted
a lot of theater.
Yeah, you'd done a lot of theater, but you'd also done some TV. You were in Get Smart episode, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Was Honeymoon Killers a game changer?
Honeymoon Killers was my first movie, yeah. I mean, my first movie, 68, I believe, yeah. we did it. And that was that's a story within itself. You know,
well, I know the making of that movie.
The making of that movie. You know.
Yeah, Leonard Castle and the whole thing. And yeah. Scorsese was started directing
yeah,
it.
Did you know that?
He's
very good.
Scorsese spent a couple of weeks directing that picture and was replaced.
Was replaced by, then that was weird. Because it was Marty's, I think, first film. And he, as far as I know, as far as the producers were concerned, it was a low budget picture. I mean, the movie was made for $125,000, and so Marty was using a lot of film, you know, and doing a lot of panning and not enough close ups for the producers. So they let him go, and they hired some guy who'd never directed before except for some industrial films, and he stood around pretty much with a script in his hand. And because I had so much theater background, you know, I would rehearse the actors and come in with this is a good idea. How about this? How about that? And so we did that for quite a while. And come the week and a half maybe of the film, and I was working with Leonard Castle throughout the whole thing. I had to change the script, cut this, do this. Because when I first got that script, it was that thick. It was like 200 pages.
Interesting. Or more.
And we cut it down. And, he said, you know, we don't even have a director on this movie. So I'm going to take over as director, Leonard. So about a week, and so here he was, written and directed by Leonard Castle, getting all this praise.
Not a filmmaker.
Not a filmmaker.
Right.
He
was a musician.
Operas.
Yeah. Wrote librettos.
Yeah. And so here it was, Leonard Castle, and getting all this, after the movie was a success, he was getting offers, but he never directed another movie.
So strange, because the movie made such a mark.
Yeah.
You know that picture, Gilbert? Honeymoon Killers?
Yeah.
Very disturbing movie.
Mm-hmm. And that was based on a true story.
Sure.
Oh, yes. Ray Fernandez and Martha Beck, they both went to the electric chair.
They did.
And it was a notorious trial, too, because she would talk about his sexual prowess, and her regret was that she could not sit on his lap while they were going to the electric chair.
Incredible.
I mean, it was quite a romance there.
Oh, and I forget the name of the actress.
Shirley Stoller.
Yes.
No, Shirley was great.
Yes.
Sure.
She was perfect. Yeah.
It was later in Seven Beauties.
She absolutely was.
That's right.
Absolutely. You played a Spaniard.
I played a Spaniard. And you want to hear a funny story? I mean, I got a million of them. I got hired by Herb Gardner, one of our great, Thousand Clowns and so on, and were hired to do a play with Milton Berle on Broadway.
That has come up billions of times.
I was burying that one for later, but go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, you did the Goodbye People.
The Goodbye People, yeah. Yes. And so I got hired to play Milton's son, you know, the Jewish uptight lawyer.
Right.
And so I say to Herb, listen, Herb, I've got to go do a movie, Honeymoon Killers. I said, but I'll be back. I'm only going to be gone a week, and I have one scene in the play, so you can jump around. And he said, no problem, but do me a favor. When we're going to have a first reading with Brenda Vaccaro and Milton and so on, he said, come back for the reading. See if you can arrange it with your producers. I do. Raymond Fernandez. So now I'm Raymond Fernandez. And so I come down and Milton says, who's this? She says, that's your son. That's Tony. He says, my son. So I knew I'm in trouble right away, you know. So we do the reading. And, of course, Milton, in the first reading, was sitting around a table. He gets up, makes an exit, goes up the stairs and for applause.
Unbelievable.
The first reading.
Unbelievable.
It's amazing. So now what happens is, while I'm away doing the movie and I'm just finishing up, I call back and I say, okay, I'm on my way. The stage manager says, don't hurry. I said, don't hurry. Why? He said, well, because when you were away, your understudy did the rot. And he looks so much more like Milton. We're going to go with him.
I see.
I said, wait a minute. You can't strike me out on the bench. I said, you hired me. So I come back and I say to Herb, I got to have a meeting with you. So I speak with him at Downey's. The great Downey's is no longer with us, as you know. That's a bar in 8th Avenue.
Yep, also gone.
Gone. And so we sit down with him, and we say, I say to him, Herb, give me 15 minutes. I'll transform back into the character. You know, I just did the Spaniard over there. He said, I'm having so much trouble with Milton. Tony, I just got to go with my instincts. I said, well, give me 15 minutes, 20 minutes. I'll do. And then he said, look, I'll call you tomorrow. I said, don't tell me you're going to call me tomorrow. You're going to call me tomorrow and say you're going to have to go with your instincts and go with him. He said, no. Okay, so he calls me tomorrow. I said, Tony, I got to go with my instincts and go with the other guy. I said, okay, here's what I'm going to do. The part you took away from me, I want to understudy it now. I want to be the understudy. He said, what? Why do you want to do that? He said, you got a run-of-the-play contract understudying the other lead, Bob Dish's part. He said, you don't have to do anything. I said, no, I want to do that. So now I do it. He said, okay, you're saving me money. So now I transform into his son. And everybody keeps saying, who's that? Who's that? Who's that? So what happens is, we're having a run-through before we go out of town with everybody in the audience, Hal Prince, Patty Chayefsky.
Wow.
You name it, who was the big guys, Elaine May, Mike Nichols, the whole mishpucha was out there.
The whole mishpucha.
So there we are. All these people out in there. So I get a call, I said, from Herb. He said, Tony, you think you can read that part for me? I said, well, I know the part. I'll do it. He said, I want to just see it. Also, the producer, terrific guy, and I forget his name.
That's okay. We'll
so
think of it.
I come in. I do the part for the producer. He said, gee, that's wonderful. Herb will be here in a while. Now, Herb is crazed, you know. It's a big night. I comes in. I said, Herb. You want me to do that thing? So I do it for him. He says, that's wonderful. Can you do that tonight? No rehearsal, nothing. I said, yeah. I said, however, I got one problem. He said, what? I don't like the way you directed the scene. He said, what do you mean? I said, it's not right. He said, well, okay. All right, you do what you want. He said, just stay out of Milton's way. That was a direction. Just stay out of Milton's way. I love that. So now I go into Milton's in there getting made up. This is nighttime, you know. Show, come on, Milton, I'm your son tonight. What? Yeah, come on, let's do some words together. But okay, yeah. So okay. So now we do the scene. We are, and in the middle of the scene, Milton stops. Everybody's out there. He says, "Are you going to say the line, or are we going to bring the curtain down?" The stage manager says, Milton, it's not him. It's your line. You're up. The line is, and he throws the line to Milton.
Wow.
Whoa, is right. And Milton came out for the bows with the towel and apologized to me, to the audience. And he said, I bet you never thought you'd see Milton Berle apologize. So then everybody came, oh, it's great, Tony. It's great. Tony, listen, we'll work you in. I said, not working me in. I'm doing the part.
Wow.
We're going out to Philly. We're going to do is never got another note outside of the Philadelphia or out of and on Broadway when we did the show on Broadway. Never received another note of the direction of the staging of so on and so forth.
That's cool.
Remarkable stuff.
Yeah, that's cool.
It's amazing.
Now, no listener of this show.
This is where Tony's going to bow out.
Would let me get away without asking you this. Do you know what Milton Berle is most famous for?
You can say it. It's
you can
be slung. Yeah, only for the internet.
Well, you know the wonderful story about Forrest Tucker.
Is this the golf
another
course
name?
Story?
Name that comes up
a lot.
And John Ireland, Forrest Tucker, were all known for their size of their memory.
John Ireland. There you go.
Another one.
Oh.
So Buddy Hackett and the guys are sitting around, and they're going to have a contest. So to see whose slung is bigger. So Buddy Hackett says, Milton, just show enough to win.
That's We heard that story with Tom Jones. Heard that story with all kinds of different people.
Oh, yeah.
That's
the same thing, just showing up to win.
Go ahead, Gil.
Who was the other one who was supposed to?
We were told Guy Marks,
Guy Marks.
Do you remember him?
No, I don't know him.
Now, so were you ever honored enough to see Milton Berle's dick?
To tell you the truth. When we were in the bathroom together at the urinals, he turned to me and he said, "Do you want to see the Big Apple?"
Gilbert's a happy man now.
I said, "No, thank you." And now I kick myself.
You kick yourself.
I would have liked to see the size of that thing.
What a moment in show business history.
Because we've had about at least three guests who've seen Milton Berle's dick.
Yeah, so. Alan Zweibel claims he saw it. I can't remember who else. Just a couple of the quick things about Honeymoon Killers, which if our listeners haven't seen Honeymoon Killers, see it, because it's a disturbing movie. And you're so absolutely creepy.
No, thank you.
In that movie.
Thank you.
And I found an old Times review, and they called you thrillingly disgusting smarminess, which is a compliment.
Compliment, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, and
Francois Truffaut's favorite movie.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And they weren't sure at first about hiring you because
that's
were
a whole
Italian.
Other story. Amazing. I'll tell you that one, too. It's, I'm working in my theater, the Triangle Theater on 88th Street between 1st and 2nd Avenue, right above, below Elaine's. And actress Marilyn Criss says to me, "You know, they're doing this movie. You should go up for it. You're perfect for it. Honeymoon Kills." So I call this woman. She said, how old are you? I told her. She said, no, you're much too young for that. And we're only seeing authentic Spanish people, too, with accents. So, okay. So Marilyn, a week passes, and she says, "They still haven't cast that part. You should really go up there." So I go up. The woman says, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Well, let me show you something." So I sit in the chair, put my hand on my hair, pull it back, and I speak to her in the Spanish accent. She says, "Oh, my God. I'll send you in." So I go into the room with the producers and speak to them only in the Spanish accent. And I get the part right away. And I only spoke to them. They said to me, "Would you mind reading other actresses that come in?" I said, "Fine. It'd be my pleasure." So, and throughout all the readings, the whole week, never spoke to them without an accent. You see, off camera, off, relax. So one of the producers said, "Do you think we can send them to school to learn English better?" Woman casting gal said, "I've got to tell you, he doesn't have an accent." He said, "What?" He said, "Tony, speak to us without an accent." I said, "No, sir, not until I sign the contract." Which I never did. I never did speak to them without the accent until I signed the contract. Because I know the mentality, you see, and that was just great. I have so many stories.
Uh-huh. Now, don't you be a stranger here. Okay. Here she is.
Hi.
You told her we're married?
Uh-huh. Mama, too.
Jesus, Martha, I go to New Jersey next week to marry Doris Acker. How am I going to bring her back here if you're here? It's impossible. You know I've got to continue my business.
Don't worry. I'll think of something.
Now, what's the matter?
Oh, that's Mama. She doesn't want to go to New York.
Martha, that's completely out of the question. I mean it. Look, you say you love me. Okay, that you're going to kill yourself if you can't come up here. Okay. But you can't bring the old lady.
What else am I going to do with her?
Get rid of her. Choke her. I don't care what the hell you do with her. But you can't bring her up here. You understand?
Tell us how William Friedkin saw you in Honeymoon Killers and what happened.
There you go. Yeah. William Friedkin and Phil D'Antoni, the producer, saw the Honeymoon Killers, and they said, "Gee, let's get him for Sal Boca." And the guy said, well, we have to go to Spain to get him. He's got a Spanish
I love
accent.
That. They thought he was Spanish.
He was Spanish. And fortunately enough, that I think Wiener, I believe, not that Wiener, but there was a casting guy and said, no, no, he's a New York actor. He doesn't have the accent. And that's how that happened. You know, that's what this business is about, boy. Perception of, you know, they say, you know, I know when I'm directing, I say, how about this actor? They say, well, I think he's working. He's over there. I said, thinking is no good. Find out for sure if he's working or he's available or not available. Because when I did Blood Brothers with Richard Gere and Paul Sorvino, that's another case. Richard Price was in my building at 365 West Edna Avenue, 77th Street. He was in my building, and he was writing this book, Blood Brothers. And we had a doorman named Jimmy who was theatrically wise, and he would talk to him, and I would talk to him about the show business. And he said, I'm writing this thing for, you think I can get Tony to read it? So he finishes it, finishes the script, and I get it, and I read it, and loved it. And so Robert Mulligan is director to Kill a Mockingbird,
yes.
Academy Award winning.
Yes.
He's the director. So I meet with him, and as thorough as I can be, I speak with him like 4 hours about the character and the movie itself. Because, you know, as you said, you know, I read a script, I read everybody's part. And the directors and the actors and so on and so forth. And I see the movie, you know, I see. So when he said, okay, you're it. He said, who do you want as your brother? Who do you want as your this and so on? So he said, I'm thinking Paul Sorvino. He said, and I said, yeah, great, great, great. He said, but I'm working with a young man for your son. He said, I'm working with him and we'll go into rehearsal and then we'll have the kid. So somewhere along the line in the rehearsal, he said, the kid is not working out. He says, I got to get a son for you. So I call my agent, Ed Lamato, who he had Richard Gere as a client. And he said, I'm going to send him over. And I said, good, I'll do the screen test with him, and I'll even negotiate his contract. I can tell you how much he can get for it, you know, which I like doing. And so
you really are thorough.
We did Richard. And Richard Gere, and he got the part, and the rest is history. It's a beautiful movie. But why I tell you that story is because they wanted me to do Fist, a Norman Jewison, and I couldn't because I was doing Blood Brothers. But what happened was they had hired a kid, I forget what actor it was, to play against Stallone, and Stallone was eating him up. On the screen, they just couldn't get there. So they inquired while I'm shooting Blood Brothers, you know, what my availability was. And it just so happened I had a week off. And so what I could do and would arrange, talk about agents and talk about, you know, if he's available, if he's not available. I had a week off from Blood Brothers. I went and did Fist for the first week because Fist jumped 20 years in the picture,
mm-hmm.
You know, 20 years later. After that week, I went back, finished up Blood Brothers, and then came back and did the rest of Fist. So I did two movies at the same time, which was...
Timing.
You know, timing.
Yeah.
All about timing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But you got to work with your friends on The French Connection.
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
And you're from a working class family.
Oh, yeah.
And... yet, when you, and I found this very surprising, when you told them you wanted to go into show business, they were very enthusiastic about that.
Yeah, yeah. As far as my father and mother and brothers were concerned, if I wanted to be going into be a acting school, I was already a star. I was already a star in their mind, you know? It's remarkable.
It's very inspiring how they would travel distances to see you in small parts.
Yeah, you're terrific how you did this research. I mean, they did. Talking about, I don't know what you want to talk about, describe this as, because when I studied acting at the dramatic workshop for a year, I was considered the guy in the school. They wanted me to go after a year to go to work. You know, I was getting all the reviews and all that jazz. And I said, I'm not ready. They said, what do you mean not ready? I said, I just learned one way of acting that you taught me. And it was I was being taught by a former choreographer. So he was generally teaching me from the outside in. And basically, being from Brooklyn and having the background of boxing and baseball and all that stuff and streets, it saved me because that I was able to be emotional and be able to fulfill the direction, which was take two steps here, turn, say the line. This is the kind of direction I was getting. Now, a lot of kids up there didn't have my background and to understand how to justify those things. So when I left that school, I learned from the outside in. It helped me a great deal of about direction and power of the stage from his point of view, you know? So, but I didn't, I was not being fulfilled because I would be able to do a scene on stage, have the audience cry, have them laugh, and be thinking, what am I going to eat after the show? What about the softball game I'm going to play? And I'm thinking, this can't be acting,
yeah. You
know? So I went to another acting school where I can learn from the inside out. But I was smart enough to say, I'm going there being dumb. Because once you think and you're the star of this other school, you think you know something. I was smart enough to say, I'm not going to go there and protest anything. I'm going to learn their half of the side. That's why I'm going there. As I was there, and I'm the kid, I was 18, 19, so I must have been 20 years old when I went to the other acting school. And after I'm there for a couple of months, the teacher comes to me and he says, I want you to teach. I said, what do you mean teach? He said, teach acting here. So what do you mean? I said, you have to have, these are young people, I'm saying. These are young people coming. You have to have the sensitivity.
No, you were 20.
To deal with them.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, he said, you see, you know that. That's why I want you to teach. So I taught for a year. I taught Mama Cass.
I love that.
You know?
Yeah, that's great.
Mama Cass. I taught Frankie Lyman.
Cass Elliott was taking acting classes.
Cass Elliott was taking acting classes.
How about that?
Yeah. And so.
The way worlds collide.
Yeah. And Samson Raphaelson. Was a teacher, Samson Raphaelson, wrote The Jazz Singer, first talking movie picture. And the other teacher was Joshua Logan, teaching directing.
About that.
And, I mean, he did all the musicals that they keep repeating and repeating and repeating. And he, in fact, it was Joshua Logan who sent me for my first reading. And my first reading was quite an adventure. I was playing a 21-year-old gigolo, kind of, I think, lover, an older woman, in a California by a swimming pool. And Carmen Capalbo was the director. They were going to do a play called Faster, Faster by Bill Marchant, I believe. Yeah. And so I went up for this reading. It was the biggest theater I've ever seen in my life. You know, I've been working in a 50-seat theater, and I'm walking onto a Broadway stage with no set on it. You're going to know how huge that is with 1,000 people audience. And here I feel like a peanut. And they've got a guy reading the girl. What do I know? So as far as I'm concerned, I'm all over him. You know, he's going to play a girl. And at one point, I say, the line I have, I say, tell me the truth. Don't I look like a Michelangelo statue? That's a great line. Carmen Capalbo laughs like you did, and he falls out of the aisle. And so what happened was, what do I know? So I called the next day and I said, do I have the part? First reading. He said, what? He said, well, no, we're thinking about it. And I said, you did very well, Tony. And if you're not getting the part, you're certainly going to be the understudy. He said, that's for sure. He said, so now the play gets canceled altogether. They don't do the play. And he said to me, I want you to be in Threepenny Opera. I said, what's that? He said, what? You haven't seen that show? I said, no. He said, okay, I want you to play the street singer. I said, street singer? What is that, you know? So he said, well, go see the show. So I go down there, Jerry Orbach is the street singer, you know, and he's singing. And I'm bowled over by that production at the Theatre de Lys, you know, the original Carmen Capalbo. And I come back, he said, did you see it? I said, yeah. He said, what do you think? I said, it's fantastic. He said, I want you to do the street singer. I said, I can't sing. He said, can you yell loud? I said, oh, yeah.
Can you yell loud?
Yeah. He said, okay, do it. So I said, then why do you want, wait a minute. I said, why do you want to hire me? You don't even know if I can act. He said, what do you mean? I saw you do the audition. I said, I had a script in my hand. I was not acting. He said, well, I want to hire you. I said, no, I got to audition for you. He said, well, okay. So I said, I want to do something that I know. So I come in, costume, makeup, everything. So the stage manager said, you ready? I said, I'm going to be ready for 20 minutes. Went upstairs, transformed into an old man, because I always played old men as young men, as a young man. Transformed, came down, they didn't know who I was. And they said, excuse me, can we help you? Oh, sorry, we're having auditions here, sorry. And I walked towards the stage, talked to them only in the voice, got up on the stage, and did a scene, a six-page monologue from Elmer Rice's Adding Machine. And they came up on stage afterward crying and say, and Carmen said, look, now will you take the job?
Showing his tears.
I said, now I'll show you I can't sing. So I was right again. He said, okay. He said, look, well, you can sing with other people. I said, oh, yeah, that I could do. Okay, be in the gang. Be in the member of a gang. I said, okay, which part? He said, Bob the Saw. Bob the Saw. Oh, yeah. Wait a minute. That part should be played by a fat man. He says, what? I said, I'll play him as a fat man, okay? Big fat man. So at this point, you're saying, do whatever you want, Tony. You do whatever you want. So now I put the padding on and the nose, the putty, the whole thing. I'll do the whole character in a fat thing. And I do the part. Now, we had the gang members used to double as beggars. And the guys used to take rags and put them over their faces and so on. Not me. I used to make a whole other character, different nose, different hair, gray, a babushka, a whole thing. And I had a line. This was a drum roll, and I would say, that must be the guard of honor. Little do they expect they'll be seeing us today. That was my line. I used to get applause every night after I delivered that line. Because I would put on I made a whole character of it. I had a voice. I went crazy. I went, that must be the god of honor. little do they expect they'll be seeing us today. And the audience would go, and it was great because the show was running for years. And a band would turn, and I was their entertainment for the night. You know, they would turn to see what I was going to do that night. You know, so it was great fun. And it's that kind of thing. When you talk about when my parents came to visit me, when I did Summer Stock, to remind you, how after the year of an acting school at the dramatic show, after the year of acting at the Actors Repertory Theater and teaching, I went away as an apprentice in Summer Stock for about $8 a week, and painted signs and did scenes.
You really immersed yourself in
really, really
in the world of being an actor.
Yeah, learning all that stuff rather than going out and, already 2 years of training. So I would go there and paint signs and be usher for all that kind of stuff. But I'd have a part. And every time I did a part, I made a whole thing of it that was not just a—
No small parts.
No small parts.
Right.
And then my mothers and father would drive up, 400 miles to come and see me.
That's
do a
nice.
Walk on.
Nice
so
that they supported
I had great,
you like
great
that.
Support. I'm very fortunate.
So you never, ever
Thanks,
sat
Charles.
Back and said, I'm a star, I know what I'm doing, or any of that.
Well, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But I don't do the star crap. I'm interested in the work. I'm interested in the people.
You're interested in every aspect of the work.
Yeah.
Tell us about your friendship with Scheider and how the
Roy.
French connection.
Well, Roy Scheider and I we'd done, I think, at least five projects together, and he worked in my theater. And the great thing is the great Jason Miller, who was also an actor but also wrote
and The Exorcist.
Exorcist.
Yes.
Billy
yeah.
Freak.
And that championship.
That's right.
That championship season. We did all of Jason's plays at my theater. Before that championship season. And in fact, he wanted me to play in the championship season downtown, but I was probably too wrapped up working for free at the Triangle Theater to do that. And that was a big mistake. So Roy Scheider performed in Jason's full-length play. And one night, Roy had to go and do Clute, I think, the movie with Jane Fonda, and it had night shoot, so he couldn't do the play, and so Jason jumped into his own play.
Oh wow!
Did the lead in his own play. That's when he was married to Jackie Gleason's daughter, Linda.
Jason, how did you get into French Connection? Was it because Friedkin saw you in Honeymoon Killers?
I think so.
And they said, this guy has to play Sal, and then you wound up.
Yeah. And I made quick friends with Sonny Grasso, the real detective that Roy played in the movie. And then
we did Popeye Doyle
Eddie. I hung out with all those guys, and that movie's just so much fun. And same thing with Seven Ups too. Same group,
which was directed by
Phil D'Antoni.
Right.
Directed and produced. Yeah.
You know the stories about French Connection and Gilbert. We've talked about it. How Jackie Gleason was pursued for Popeye Doyle and Lee Marvin and
I think Frank Sinatra.
I heard they shot with Jimmy. They started Breslin, out with Jimmy Breslin.
Breslin,
did you know that?
Yeah. Oh no!
Yeah. Peter Boyle turned it down.
Frank Sinatra was wanted for Dirty Harry.
Dirty Harry.
Oh,
yeah,
really?
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I know Gleason was considered.
Really?
But he just come off of a film that didn't do well.
Wow, I didn't hear that one. Yeah. That's great.
Then the stuff about it too. I mean the chase scene, they didn't have the proper permits.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Wild stuff. Real wild stuff.
Who is that clown? Jewish lucky man. What about the last of big time spenders? You make him?
No, you.
He's spreading it around like the Russians are in Jersey. They say we stick around and give him a tail.
Our friend's name is Boca. Salvatore Boca. B-O-C-A. Well, downtown, they're pretty sure he pulled off a contract on a guy named DeMarco.
And that's not a drop. I'll open up a charge for you at Bloomingdale's.
B-O-C-A.
Doesn't matter.
And then on our own, after working a whole day and night, we tail him to Brooklyn. And we sat on him for practically a week. Now, who do we come up with?
The French Connection. A millionaire exporter with a record too clean to be true. And Doyle knows it. But he's been known to make mistakes.
Your hunches have backfired before, Doyle.
This time, he can't afford to be wrong.
Didn't they actually almost hit that woman in the chasing?
Well, at one point, I think he hits a car that he wasn't supposed to hit.
Yeah, so
or two.
A couple of those things, yes.
And Fernando Rey was cast by mistake because
he was trying
to get a different actor.
They were sitting, Phil and Billy Friedkin were watching a movie, a foreign film. And they wanted this actor.
I think it was Belle du Jour.
Was it Belle du Jour? And they wanted this actor, and they sent the wrong actor. They sent Fernando Rey. And Billy went to meet him at the airport, and he called Phil, and he says, "The guy got the wrong actor." Phil said, "Well, what does he look like? He's got a beard and everything." And he said, "Well, ask him if he wants to cut the beard off." And he said, "Yes." And he said, "Oh, no, I have the bed skin underneath or something."
Your wife is outside. Your wife, Elise, who we met, is outside, and she's holding up a sign saying that you have to go to dinner.
Oh,
but tell us one thing about Larry Cohen, who's somebody that we love.
Oh,
on this
Larry
show.
Cohen, my goodness,
who put you in the movie God Told Me To? Yes, which we were talking about.
We did a play together too, a play called Nature of the Crime. Larry saw me in Honeymoon Killers, and he cast me in this role of a genius. Jewish, homosexual fellow. And I said to him, "Why are you casting me in that role?" I said, "What have you seen me do?" I said, "Honeymoon Killers." I said, "That's fascinating that you're doing that." I said, "Do you know that I can really do that?" He said, "I do." I said, "I don't believe you. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to cast this part for you." He said, "What?" He said, "I'm going to get five actors who are right for this role. I mean, I know I can do this role, and I want to do it. But I want you to really understand, even though you want to hire me, I want you to see these other actors." So he auditioned all the actors. And I said, "So what do you think?" He said, "I want you." I said, "Why do you want me?" He said, "Because you're going to give me something more." They gave me everything they've got, but you're going to give me another thing. It's one of the best roles I've ever played. And I based the character on him and a fellow I played poker with and invited him to the show.
Interesting.
And the guy said, "My God, that's me. That's me up there." The guy who I played poker with. Amazing. But anyway, then when I was doing Yanks 3, Detroit Nothing, top of the seventh of the play, Larry came to me and asked me to do this movie, Too Scared to...
God Told Me To.
And so we did. We shot the movie in the daytime, and I did my play at night. except on Wednesday when I had two shows, so we didn't shoot that day. He shot something else. And that's how we shot that movie.
It's a crazy movie. It's a police procedural that turns into a supernatural horror film.
Yeah. And Deborah Raffin, Sylvia Sidney, sure. Sam Levine.
Yeah.
I saw somewhere that you protested or were just very strongly opposed to in the Metropolitan Opera House when they were putting on the production of The Death of Leon Klinghoffer.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the audacity of them to disrespect that man and praise the terrorist. I'm very much involved in Israel and very big. I've been to Israel 3 times now, and the short shrift and prejudice against the Israelis is ridiculous. Just jealousy. I mean, they're brilliant people. Have more Nobel Prizes than anybody in this small little country of it, and that they would put on a play that would praise the terrorists and it was just awful.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, Elisa's going to get mad at us because she's got to take you to dinner. So set up this piece that you were kind enough to show us before, and we'll get you out of here.
You know, my friends, in all the movies that I've done, which is about 102, to be precise, and all the play directed and so on and so forth, there comes time when something crosses your heart and you feel you must do it. And it's a poem called Just a Common Soldier, by A. Lawrence Vaincourt. This is embedded at West Point, engraved in a statue at West Point. It touched my heart, and I learned it, and a friend said, we must film this. We did, 2 years ago, and it's a 5-minute video, and I implore you to go to justacommonsoldier.com on YouTube or whatever, and you'll see this video. It has received 2 Emmys, and it has reached 22 million views, which is astonishing number in 2 years. And I know they're going to play it for you.
Yeah, we're going to play it to take out the episode. So
thank you so much.
We'll
but
get,
I do
we'll
urge you to see
it
for yourself,
it's very
because
touching.
The visual of it is a tribute to the great men. The great men and women who have fought this country and has given our freedom, and given us our freedom, and they don't get their due. And every time this thing is shown, when it's 22 million views, that probably translate to maybe 30 million or so people or more that have seen it, not counting when I do it at events, you know, because that doesn't get in a view, maybe 800 people in there. But it's really something you want to see. But you'll hear it.
We'll play it, and also we send people to the website so they can actually see the visuals.
God bless you.
And we watched it before this interview, and it was really powerful.
Thank you. Thank
Anything
you.
Else to plug? Yeah. Anything else besides the softball game tomorrow? You still doing Fiorello?
I'm doing Fiorello, yes. I've been asked to do it in Philadelphia, again, where I did it once before, and also another theater where my dear friend Dina Martin, Dean Martin's daughter, performed at a theater, I think in New Jersey, and we're going to do it there. And some other people want to do it for campaigns, supporting. Because I did it, when John Catsimatidis was running for mayor, he bought 19 shows and attended every one, and he pointed, this is the way I want to be mayor of New York City,
Now, Fiorello LaGuardia.
The man has to go to dinner.
I know. I know. I know. And your wife is going to kill me.
All right, last question.
Okay. He used to read
the comics.
On the radio.
Yeah, he read Dick Tracy.
Yeah. Was it during a newspaper strike?
Newspaper strike, yeah. He said, well, the newspaper strike isn't over, and I suppose the children want to hear something about their funnies. Do you miss them? Well, let's look at Dick Tracy. Let's see what Dick Tracy is doing. Oh, that's fantastic.
Well, I should let you go because your wife is going to get really
pissed.
She's going
to come in here in a minute.
And you let me eat, so I'm going to have to let you eat.
This has been Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast with my co-host Frank Santopadre. And as much as I'm against all the guineas who have been on this show, he does support Israel, and he did have an opportunity to see Milton Berle's cock.
which he passed up.
Yes, which I'll never forgive you for. But that, we want to thank the great Tony LoBianco.
The actor's actor.
By.
Thank you, pal. Thank you, both of you.
Tony, thanks. We know you're busy, and we appreciate you coming in and giving us your time.
My pleasure. Man. I enjoyed being with you, both you guys. You're great.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll see you again.
God bless America.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
He was getting old and paunchy, and his hair was falling fast. And he sat around the Legion telling stories of the past, of a war that he had fought in, and the deeds that he had done, in his exploits with his buddies. They were heroes, every one. And though sometimes to his neighbors his tales became a joke, all his Legion buddies listened, for they knew whereof he spoke. But we'll hear his tales no longer, for old Bill has passed away. The world's a little poorer, for a soldier died today. He will not be mourned by many, just his children and his wife. For he lived an ordinary and quite uneventful life. He held a job and raised a family, quietly going his own way. And the world won't note his passing, though a soldier died today. When politicians leave this earth, their bodies lie in state, while thousands note their passing and proclaim that they were great. Papers tell their whole life stories from the time that they were young. But the passing of a soldier goes unnoticed and unsung. Is the greatest contribution to the welfare of our land a guy who breaks his promise and cons his fellow man? Or the ordinary fellow who in times of war and strife goes off to serve his country and offers up his life? A politician's stipend and the style in which he lives are sometimes disproportionate to the service that he gives, while the ordinary soldier who has offered up his all is paid off with a medal, perhaps a pension, small. It's so easy to forget them, for it was so long ago that the old Bills of our country went to battle. But we know it was not the politicians with their compromises and ploys who won for us the freedom that our country now enjoys. Should you find yourself in danger with your enemies at hand, would you want a politician with his ever-shifting stand? Or would you prefer a soldier who has sworn to defend his home, his kin, and country, and would fight until the end? He was just a common soldier, and his ranks are growing thin. But his presence should remind us we may need his like again. For when countries are in conflict, then we find the soldier's part is to clean up all the troubles that the politicians start. If we cannot do him honor while he's here to hear the praise, then at least let's give him homage at the ending of his days. Perhaps just a simple headline in a paper that would say, "Our country is in mourning for a soldier died today."
Gilbert Gottfried's amazing Colossal Podcast is produced by Dara Gottfried and Frank Santapadre, with audio production by Frank Verderosa. Our researchers are Paul Rayburn and Andrea Simmons. Web and social media is handled by Mike McPadden, Greg Pear, Nancy Chinchar, and John Bradley Seals. Special audio contributions by John Beach. Special thanks to John Murray, John Fotiatis, and Nutmeg Creative, especially Sam Giovanco and Daniel Farrell for their assistance.